5 goes to you, dagger, fine. V, well, this comes from here, and this comes from here, something like that. And then we went to eigenvalues, and we found it convenient not to fix the gauge completely, but to write the system in terms of the complex eigenvalues. And we have eigenvalues, complex eigenvalues. We have n complex eigenvalues, lambda I, which are fermions. So our fermions now do not move on a line, but they move on a plane. The remaining gauge symmetry, the remaining U1 that rotates the eigenvalue lambda, acts on this plane as rotation, and therefore Gauss' law sets the angular momentum for each eigenvalue to zero. So we will find it convenient to think of these eigenvalues from many different points of view, either with polar coordinates, or polar coordinates and forget about the angle and have only the radial direction, in which case, which we presented yesterday, lambda I are real and positive. Or sometimes we'll find it convenient to retain the bigger perspective of the whole complex plane and to use Cartesian coordinates. And we will move now back and forth between these different descriptions. This is really an elementary exercise in quantum mechanics, which is the reason this thing is solvable. So for these eigenvalues in the plane, we derived eventually a Lagrangian. The Lagrangian was, or the Hamiltonian, was minus d lambda square minus quarter over lambda square. This is the centrifugal force, plus v of lambda, which are replaced by an inverted harmonic oscillator. So the problem before we go to polar coordinates has two decoupled harmonic oscillators, one in the x direction, the other in the y direction. Both of them are inverted. And in polar coordinates, that's the Hamiltonian. Is this big enough that can be is readable from the back? It's small? And this quarter is familiar to anybody who ever did quantum mechanics in two dimensions. If we have angular momentum, we have a shift here. And without the angle, but even for angular momentum zero, there's some repulsion to the origin. In two dimensions, there's repulsion. In three dimensions, there's none. L equals zero is zero. And if you go up in four dimensions, there's repulsion from the origin, even for L equals zero. So this is the quarter. So the critical behavior is obtained. Remember, this is just the radius. So we have a potential that looks like that from here. And this gives some repulsion. So there's a little bit of repulsion. The critical behavior is somewhere here at mu equals zero. But there's nothing singular at that point. So how do we solve this system? We go one step backwards. And we think of these complex lambdas before we go to angular variables and we impose that the angular momentum is zero. So we go one step back. Now we have two harmonic oscillators. That's the quickest way to, by the way, to solve. Even if you have a plus sign here, you have a harmonic oscillator in the plane. The quickest way to do that is not with polar coordinates, but with Cartesian coordinates, because now you have two decoupled harmonic oscillators. So we have two upside down harmonic oscillators. Each of them has its own S and its own U. Where one corresponds to, say, the X direction and two corresponds to the Y direction. And SI and UI are canonically conjugate to each other. Now we are going to go to polar coordinates. We really want to solve the problem with polar coordinates. So we define a new variable s, which is the square root of s1 squared plus s2 squared, and another variable u, which is the square root of u1 squared plus u2 squared. There are also two other angles that we could have defined, theta s and theta u, in the obvious fashion. And now we can diagonal, we can ask, how does angular momentum work? Angular momentum performs rotations in the plane. Therefore, what it does is rotates in the plane 1, 2, rotates the two u's and the two s's. And that has the effect of shifting both theta s and theta u by a constant. There's only one angular momentum in the problem. We can diagonalize and set it to 0. So that means that the final answer, or the wave function, are independent of the angle. And they are independent both of theta s and of theta u. Now, it's really important to stress that unlike the one-dimensional problem, these two guys are not canonically conjugate to each other. If x and px are canonically conjugate, r and pr are not canonically conjugate. And especially here, s and u are obtained through this complicated change of variables. But this doesn't stop us from writing the Hamiltonian, and you can process the go through the change of variables. I'm not going to do the whole thing here. You can also find it in the papers I referred to. The Hamiltonian can be written as either as s ps, or in the u basis as minus a half u pu, where pu and ps are the momenta conjugate to s. And we can also find our important inner product, which will in the end become the transform from the past to the future or to our S matrix. The easiest way to find that is to work in Cartesian coordinates. Now we have a Fourier transform from Si to Ui. We do it separately for one and the other. And then we change variables to these objects, the square root, to the radial directions. And we find an expression which is no longer a Fourier transform. This is a Bessel function. The details are not important. And this is what the inner product is. So now the kernel is not as simple as it was before. But the Hamiltonian retains its simplicity. In fact, we'll soon see that it's even simpler than the previous problem. Now we can diagonalize the Hamiltonian. So everything I said so far is true, regardless of what the Hamiltonian is. That's true for any system. We can parameterize phase space this way, and we have this inner product between one representation and the other. Now we can diagonalize the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is a free Hamiltonian. And the eigenstates are labeled by the energy. And again, there are two bases. Bases I'll call the out bases, with essentially the same wave function. So there's 1 over root 2 pi s to the ie minus a half. And we have the u basis in which the instates are simple. So the wave functions are very similar to the wave functions we had before, with two differences. Number one, before we had two wave functions for each energy, whereas now we have only one wave function for each energy. More explicitly, before we said we have this expression for positive s and 0 for negative s, or the other way around. Now we have only one wave function because there is no negative s. S and u are radial coordinates. They are non-negative. And indeed, if we look at motion in this potential, there's no other side. Lambda is always positive. So we have one incoming mode and one outgoing mode. And that's what we need to describe. So taking these wave functions and taking this kernel, we can compute the inner product, which will be our S matrix, which takes us from E out and E prime in. And it's a very similar calculation to the one we did before. It's a delta of E minus E prime some phase, which is not too exciting. Does not affect the physics. And now our favorite gamma function. So up to the delta function, which has to be there for energy conservation, the rest is a phase, which is exactly what we would have expected. So it's a lot simpler than what we had before. Now we have a one-dimensional Hilbert space for each energy. And we have two natural bases for these energies, what we call the incoming basis and the outgoing basis. And the difference between them is that they are related by a phase, an energy-dependent phase, which can also be referred to as a phase shift. So if you send a plane wave in, you see a plane wave coming back out with a certain phase shift. From this perspective, you send a plane wave in, it remains a plane wave in. If you just re-express it in terms of the out basis, they differ by a phase, and all of the physics is derived from that phase. The next thing we did in this zero B theory was to study the second quantized problem. So we just follow the same route we had before. We write the second quantized Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is an integral d lambda from 0 to infinity, not from minus infinity to infinity, psi dagger of lambda and t, I dt plus a half minus d square minus lambda square minus a quarter over lambda square minus mu psi. So what do? We write I d by dt, and then the Hamiltonian minus the Hamiltonian. Doesn't matter. Write it like that, and that would be the system we have to study. And just as we did before, we go from the lambda basis to the u basis, and we express this thing as follows for the following transform. So we define psi s of s and t and psi u of u and t as an integral d lambda, square root of 2 lambda s, this is from 0 to infinity, lambda s, e to the I, lambda square over 2 plus s square over 2. And unlike the other problem, here we have some Bessel function. And again, the details are not important, and they can be found in the literature. And similarly here, an integral d lambda square root of 2 lambda u e to the I minus I lambda square over 2 plus u square over 2 J0 root 2 u lambda psi lambda and t. And if we plug this in here, or plug the inverse in here, we can express the Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian in terms of a this is the Lagrangian. We can express it in terms of these degrees of freedom. And you can check that going from here to here is achieved using this kernel here. So I'm doing it quickly because we've done it already before. And finally, the last change of variables that we did before was to define psi in and psi out as e to the r over 2 psi u, with u equals e to the r. So the in and the out is also e to the r over 2 psi s, s equals e to the r. Notice that since u and s are positive, we don't have a plus or minus sign here, and correspondingly, there's only one field. And finally, we can write the Lagrangian in this basis, which is our final answer. We have an integral dr from minus infinity to infinity, psi dagger in, I dt minus dr minus mu psi in. Or we can write that as an integral dr, psi dagger out, same thing with I, except that we have dt plus dr minus mu psi out. So it's a long change of variables, but in the end of the day, we end up with something very similar to what we had before. Free relativistic fermions with a few exceptions. So what it looks superficially very much like what we had before, but one distinction is completely obvious. We have only one species of fermion, not two. We had two species of fermions before, two incoming and two outgoing. Now we have only one incoming and one outgoing. And the second thing is that translation from one to the other, which we can write in a way similar to what we had before, is a little bit more complicated. Psi, where did I work it out? Out is an integral dr prime. This is a function of r and t. Dr prime, e to the r plus r prime, j0 of e to the r plus r prime, psi e of r prime. So our final description of the system, we've forgotten about the complex matrices, we've forgotten about everything. The only thing that remains are an incoming, a description of the incoming states, and a description of the outgoing states, and the dictionary between them, which is the S matrix, which is not a Fourier transform here. And the symmetries are also manifest now. One symmetry is fermion number. We rotate psi by a phase, psi in, and that translates to symmetry that rotates psi out by a phase. The transform between them guarantees that we don't have two separate U1 symmetries, one for the incoming and one for the outgoing. And what about our other two other Z2 symmetries? The charge conjugation symmetry, minus one to the big F, acts trivially here. It's trivial. And our S duality symmetry, which was minus one to the little one F left, Wolchit, acts as psi in or out, psi in or out, dagger. So it simply acts as charge conjugation. Any questions so far? Yeah. That's right. So all the physics is in this phase. Before, this was a two-dimensional space, so they were the same up to a 2x2 unitary matrix. Now they are the same up to a 1x1 unitary matrix, which is a phase. You don't have to choose. You're welcome to work with special functions. In which case, as much as you might not like this formalism, I guarantee you it's much more complicated. Well, there's a natural normalization for S and U for the wave functions. See, the wave functions are just S to a power rather than S to a power multiplied by a function of E. In terms of R, which is S is E to the R, this is a plane wave. So all these chains of variables, if you just look at that, the e to the r over 2 here simply kills the half. And s, in terms of r, it's e to the I energy times r. So this is a plane wave. And this is a plane wave. But the way you relate in and out, you take an incoming plane wave and an outgoing plane wave. And you could have redefined the incoming state by a phase which depends on energy. If you had done that, you have thrown away the baby with the, that one. That's the way it's usually formulated, yeah. I actually prefer the other way of thinking about it. The thing is that in this language, nothing comes out. It's just a plane wave that goes in. And it moves from u equals minus infinity, sorry, from u equals infinity, say, to u equals 0. And the region near u equals 0 is reinterpreted as s going to infinity, which is the particle bouncing back. Any other questions? OK. Now, of great interest in the problem are the Ramon-Ramon fluxes. I spent a lot of time talking about them. How can we take this model and modify to introduce the Ramon-Ramon fluxes? And remember, the story was rather elaborate. We had two kinds of Ramon-Ramon fluxes, but the answers appeared to depend only on the sum, and there were fundamental strings. And there was a whole story there in space-time. So we would like to reconstruct all this out of the matrix model. So we'll take our intuition, again, from the picture in terms of Debye. So the way I motivated this particular model, the 0A matrix model, is by thinking of unstable Debye. We're thinking of unstable Debye, and we started with n Debye and n anti-Debye. So imagine we wanted to add more Debye. Recall in one phase of the model, the Ramon-Ramon flux was carried by Debye. So we started originally with n Debye and n Debye. And they were unstable, as Sen taught us, and then they decay and they give this whole structure. So the way to introduce Debye is very simple. We just need to start with n plus q Debye plus n anti-Debye. So now n d debye pair will decay, and q Debye will remain. How do we do that in the matrix model? So we just need to extend what we did before for arbitrary q. For simplicity, let me take q to be positive. Well, it's very easy. We had these complex matrices, which were n by n. So all we need to do is make the matrices rectangular. So now we have rectangular matrices. The gauge symmetry is extended to un cross un plus q. And we have now a matrix model which describes the 0A system in the presence of q Debye, or in the presence of Ramon-Ramon flux q. And you have seen such quiver models, as they're called, in some of the other lectures in this school. It's a very natural construction using Debye. There's a un that acts on the anti-Debye, and a un plus q that acts on the others. And the open strings between them are in this rectangular matrix. So we need to repeat the whole exercise for rectangular matrices. But this is really easy, because we are first going to pick a gauge. Where we set all these matrix elements to 0. That's a good gauge choice. And there is a Jacobian for this gauge choice. So if we call this matrix F phi sub q, this can be thought of as phi sub 0. And now we have a matrix model only for phi 0. But the only effect of setting zeros here is that the measure is slightly different. And the measure has another factor . One way to see that is that, what does this measure represent? It represents the volume of the gauge group that we have to take into account. If phi 0 imagine phi 0 is diagonal, and it has a 0 eigenvalue. Then by setting this to 0, we have not yet fixed completely the gauge. But if we divide by the gauge group, by the same constant volume of the gauge group, we have to give it to produce an extra 0, which is produced by this determinant. Another analogy is if we think of a particle moving in large number of dimensions, there's suppression near the origin. And what Q does is as if we act in more dimensions. So we by hand introduce the factor of the radius times the appropriate power of dimensions that we lost. Anyway, you want to look at it. Our model is very much like the model we had before, except that the measure is slightly different. And you can go through the same algebra. You diagonalize the matrix phi naught, and add the extra factor of the measure. And what this says is that now the complex eigenvalues lambda correspond to a particle representing fermion moving in a plane but this time with angular momentum Q. So the Ramon-Ramon flux, which is described by adding more brains to the system, more charged brains to the system. In the end of the day, what it does to these eigenvalues, it says, yep, they still move in the same plane, and we still need to impose Gauss' law that they have fixed angular momentum, but the fixed angular momentum is no longer zero, but it's Q. There's an intuitive way to understand that. Imagine we have some more eigenvalues at the origin. So what do? They try to repel other eigenvalues, which sits in the C. Why do they want to repel them? Because they're fermions. And the fermion in the C sees more eigenvalues sitting at the origin. That's a way of understanding this extra repulsion coming from the determinant. In terms of the motion of the in the plane, it's the same thing. Having high angular momentum provides centrifugal repulsion from the origin. And that has the effect of making the wave functions of the fermion localized further and further away from the origin. So that's what the Ramon-Ramon flux does. So now we have to go through our S and U variables and do the whole thing again. And I'm not going to do that. I'll just write the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is very much like what it was before, d squared, then we had minus lambda squared, that's the potential, plus q squared minus 1/4 over lambda squared. And this is the form, this is the analog of LL plus 1 that you're familiar with in 3 dimensions. That's what it is in 2 dimensions if you have angular momentum q. And you can go through the whole thing as before. And I'll do again something that I can easily do on the blackboard, but you cannot do in your notes. Wherever you see a subscript 0 here, the subscript has to turn into Q. That's the only difference. So the two Lagrangians are unchanged. The two incoming and outgoing Lagrangians do not change. We still have one free relativistic fermion moving in, one free relativistic fermion moving out. But the transforms between them is a little bit modified. So instead of 0, we have Q. With 0, we have Q. Instead of 0, we have Q. And here is the complete solution of the problem with non-trivial flux. And one formula that I would like to add here that I had before is if we take the fixed energy states and we compute the S matrix, there is a phase shift, e to the I phi e. This is the phase that translates an energy eigenstate from the left to the right. I wrote the formula before, I think it was on this blackboard, for q equals 0. And the generalization to arbitrary q is q plus 1, 2 to the minus I e, gamma of 1/2, 1 plus q minus IP over gamma for half 1 plus Q plus IP. So all the expressions are very similar, and everything is under control. So what we have done so far is to introduce the Ramon-Ramon flux Q. Any questions on that before I move to the second Ramon-Ramon flux? Everybody's worn out? I must say that sitting through these lectures, I really admire the students who can sit through so many lectures and not fall asleep. I find it difficult to stay awake in my own talk. What about Q tilde? Again, we take our intuition from the D brains. Let's set this Q to zero. So now we start with, again, N D brains and N anti-D brains. And we put it Ramon-Ramon flux in. And we ask, what is the effect of the Ramon-Ramon flux on the D brains? So you open your favorite book or paper on D brains, and you just read off the answer. The flux Q tilde from the other Ramon-Ramon flux has leads to an extra term in the Lagrangian of the D brains. The D brains, recall we're in a UN, for us UN matrix model, they were phi, complex matrix phi, and let us denote the gauge fields of this by A, and the gauge fields of this one by A tilde. So if you open your favorite paper on D brain, you will see that the coupling of the Ramon-Ramon flux Q tilde has the following term added to the Lagrangian. In fancier ways, we can say that this is a Chern-Simons term, except that in this case, it's a Chern-Simons term in one dimension. We have only time. The only dimension is time. So we have a Chern-Simons term in one dimension. And now we would like to see what does such a term do to our dynamics. So we all know that if we have Ramon-Ramon flux, the way it interacts with the walled volume of the D brains is by adding such Chern-Simons terms. In our case, the Chern-Simons term is particularly simple. So we go again through the same exercise. We fix a gauge that all the lambdas are diagonal but complex. We have remaining gauge symmetry that rotates each eigenvalue in the plane. The remaining gauge fields appear here. So that becomes Q tilde tilde dt sum over I ai minus ai tilde. These are the eigenvalues of matrix A. And now we come to impose Gauss' law of these diagonal gauge fields. And what Gauss' law says is, what is Gauss' law? We've already seen that many times here. This is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the gauge field. This is what we do when we pick the axial gauge and the gauge field is zero. So we set A to zero. This would be our gauge choice. And when we look at its equation of motion, the equation of motion tells us that the angular momentum in the plane, which is the charge that this A couples to, equals Q tilde. This is quite familiar. If you have a Chern-Simons in quantum mechanics, it has the effect of saying that the state in the system are not invariant under your U1 symmetry, but carry a given charge under the symmetry, and the charge is the coefficient of the Chern-Simons term. And if you haven't gone through this exercise yet, I guarantee you that somewhere in your career you will see this more than once. This appears in many different applications. So this is very fortunate and puzzling. It's fortunate that it's exactly the same answer that we had for the other Ramon-Ramon flux Q. And it's very fortunate that we don't need to do any new calculation. All the calculations we did are exactly the same. The reason is, of course, totally different. before we introduced Ramon-Ramon flux, Q, by making the matrices into rectangular matrices. Now we introduce Ramon-Ramon flux, Q tilde, by adding another term to the Lagrangian. We don't change the number of D brains. It's a totally different physics. But the outcome is exactly the same. These fermions, complex fermions moving in the plane, carry non-trivial angular momentum. And the puzzling thing is, why are these two the same? Why is it that we have two different Ramon-Ramon fluxes, which do exactly the same to the matrix model? I'm not going to do it here, but you can take this step one step further and imagine you want to do both. Let's turn on both Q and Q tilde. So it's completely clear what needs to be done. We'll both extend the matrices to become rectangular. That will take care of Q. We'll add the Chern-Simons term to account for Q tilde. And then there's a little bit of work showing that the answers, with both Q and Q tilde, the answers depend only on Q plus Q tilde. We have seen that to leading order in the first lecture. In the first lecture, we found that the energy was Q squared plus the Q tilde square, and then I said that we have to add Q plus Q times Q tilde fundamental strings, and the coefficients work out exactly such to make a perfect square, so the energy was Q plus Q tilde quantity square. Now we see that this is not just a peculiarity of the term quadratic in Q, or for a term which scales like the torus amplitude, but this is an exact result in the matrix model, which is true for mu positive, mu negative, mu equals zero, and so forth. So there's enormous reduction in the complexity of the problem. Instead of having functions of two variables, Q and Q tilde, we have only one. Yes, exactly the same, because the answers depend only on this, and therefore, for simplicity, set one of them to zero. And then it goes back to, so wherever I wrote Q before, just write Q plus Q tilde, and you have the formula for any Q and Q tilde. I don't have a clear space-time understanding of this. This is an enormous reduction in the complexity of the problem, which must have a simple interpretation, a simple reason in space-time. I don't have such an interpretation. Which term? No, it does not. No. Only after gauge fixing are they the same. Because what this thing, if you write it in the exponent, it would be the log of the determinant. But it depends on phi, it doesn't depend on the gauge fields. The other depends only on the gauge fields. And surprisingly, after we fix a gauge, they are the same. So physically, they're the same system. The presentation is totally different. Maybe in the language of today, we should call it that they are dual to each other. So I could say quite a lot more about these models that can be analyzed in great detail, but I would like to do a few other things. So we'll leave it as is and change direction a little bit, change the problem. So before I do that, are there any questions? Okay, so if you are indeed overwhelmed, now it's time to wake up because you can forget all that because we're going to start a new topic, which will be kind of a TA session of my lectures. Do an exercise. What have we learned so far? Well, we've learned quite a lot. We had space-time, we had matrix model. One thing that we learned is that in the end, everything works out. Things are consistent and things work and everything has a sensible interpretation. And some things are easier to understand from one point of view, other things are easier to understand or calculate from another point of view, but in the end, things work out. The second thing we'll learn is that it's really a lesson of the last incarnation of this problem, is that physics is completely smooth at mu equals zero. The bosonic string is unstable, and it becomes more and more unstable as we bring mu towards zero. But this type zero theory is perfectly smooth at mu equals zero, where it's very strongly coupled. So for large positive and large negative mu, we can use string perturbation theory. At mu equals zero, we cannot use string perturbation theory. String perturbation theory is singular, but the exact answers are perfectly smooth in mu. There's no phase transition. And that appeared all over these things. All these expressions are analytic functions of mu or the energy. Furthermore, the asymptotic analysis I had in the first lecture, which one might have worried is not justified, turns out to be correct. So as long as we think very carefully about physics at the weak coupling end, ignoring mu altogether, we don't miss much. There's a lot of physics that we miss, but we don't get wrong answers about the physics at the weak coupling end. In the previous incarnation of this puzzle, it was always kind of worrisome that setting mu to zero is dangerous. We really need mu in order to get reflection of the barrier, in order to make the theory well-defined. And therefore, analyzing the theory locally at large phi might be misleading. This was really the prevailing point of view at the time. Now we see that that's not true. Local physics is perfectly good. It misses a lot. It misses what happens if we throw something in and it bounces back at us. But doing local physics with mu equals zero is a perfectly valid thing to do. It missed some things. It was another lesson that we saw. It missed all these solitons, which are non-perturbative. But if we only looked sufficiently carefully at the effective Lagrangian, we saw that these solitons were there. So the lesson from all that is that, yes, there are these solitons. The world sheet analysis does not tell us about these massless solitons. But as long as we work at weak coupling and we think sufficiently hard about what's going on there, we don't miss anything. So I'm going to take this point of view and try to construct new theories which do not have a parameter mu. So we don't even have the option of turning on mu. And we don't even have a matrix model for them. I believe there is a matrix model for them. I believe it will be interesting to work, to find it out, find out what it is, but I don't know what it is. So I'm going to have now a really lowbrow analysis, repeating what we did in the first lecture, but for two new theories. We'll see that they're somewhat interesting. So we had our 0A and 0B theory, and each of them had two Z2 symmetries that we talked about at length. So we could ask what happens if we overfold these theories by these Z2 symmetries. In 10 dimensions, we know what happens. We take the 0A and the 0B theory, we mod out by these Z2 symmetries, and here come the type 2 theories. So the next topic is the type 2 theories. So the first theory I'll discuss is the 2B theory. So we take the 0A theory, sorry, the 0B theory, and mod it out by the symmetry that maps T to minus T and C goes to C tilde. This was our S duality. Clearly, if we mod out by a symmetry, the changes, which on the world sheet was minus 1 to the little f left, world sheet for example. Clearly, if we mod out by t goes to minus t, we first have to make sure that t in the background is 0, i.e. mu equals 0. So this is the procedure we use in 10 dimensions. We take the 0B theory, 10 dimensions, and we mod it out by this Z2 symmetry. And we find the 2B theory. That's not the historical way these things were found. Historically, they were found the opposite way. people first had the 2B theory and then found a more elementary 0B theory. And we can go either way. So what is the spectrum? From the NS and S sector, we had a tachyon before. It's projected out. From the Ramon-Ramon sector, we had a C plus and a C minus. Or maybe C in and C out. One of them is even, the other is odd under this symmetry. It maps C with C tilde. So we cross that out. And we are left with incoming state. We have only an incoming C field. And let me write the vertex operator for you, because this is a TA session. So write e to the minus phi over 2 minus phi bar over 2 plus I over 2 h plus h bar plus I px plus 1 minus p phi. And that exists only for p larger or equal 0, so I don't need to put the absolute value here. What's the next step? So this is the untwisted sector. We've thrown away some states which are not invariant under our Z2 symmetry. The next step is to work out the twisted sector. And here comes the surprise. The naive thing to do is to look at your favorite book, see what is being done in 10 dimensions, and do the same. If you do that, you find no states in the twisted sector, and you actually find the spectrum of operators, which is inconsistent. However, if you do the opposite sign of the projection, opposite to what you do in 10 dimensions, you end up with a sensible spectrum. So the twisted sector has two kinds of states, R and S and N S R, which have vertex operators, e to the minus phi over 2 minus phi bar minus I h over 2 plus I p x plus 1 minus p absolute value phi. And p has to be less than or equal 0. From here, we get e to the minus phi minus phi bar over 2 minus I h bar over 2 plus IPX plus 1 minus P absolute value phi, which again, P less than or equal to 0. So what does it mean in space-time? The spectrum includes C, which is only left mover or in, which moves this way, and two fermions, one from NSR and one from RNS, which move this way. This looks like a sensible spectrum. Particularly, it doesn't have any gravitational anomalies. We have one scalar moving one way and two fermions moving in the opposite direction. This theory is really deserves the name type 2B. It's very reminiscent of things we know in 10 dimensions. On the world sheet, the theory has worldsheet parity. What happens for the left movers on the worldsheet, the same thing happens for the right movers on the worldsheet. The other hand, it does not have parity in space-time, very much like the 2B theory in 10 dimensions. It has a self-dual form. This chiral scalar is a self-dual form. This is what would be the self-dual form of 10 dimensions. So in 10 dimensions, we have various we have one self-dual form. In 2 dimensions, this is the self-dual form, so it must have that. So this is the entire spectrum of particles. So let me put that with two arrows, because it has kind of twice as many degrees. So nice as it is, this spectrum is a bit puzzling. It's puzzling because imagine we throw in a C field. Then by the various Z2 symmetries in the problem, we must get out an even number of fermions. Equivalently, if we reverse the past and the future, if we throw in an odd number of fermions, this odd number of fermions cannot come back out, because we have only scalars. So if we just look at the worldsheet spectrum, we see that this theory cannot have a unitary S matrix. We throw in, let me reverse what I called in and out. It's easy to do on the blackboard. So outgoing particles are only the C field. Incoming particles are these two Majorana Weyl fermions with the same chirality. So we throw in an odd number of fermions, say three, and the outgoing spectrum cannot preserve the Z2 symmetry. How can that be? Well, by now the resolution should be obvious. C is a compact scalar field. It can have solitons, massless solitons, which carry fermion number. In fact, more detailed analysis shows that C is compactified at a free fermion radius. So the incoming spectrum is a C equals one system at the free fermion radius, just the left movers, and the outgoing spectrum is the right moving spectrum of the same C equals one system. So again, we see that we can save unitarity only by invoking the existence of new massless solitons. In this case, these are the fermions made out of C. In our previous example, we had such things that in the matrix model, it was completely obvious what they are. These are in eigenvalues, which kind of we form in a fermion hole pair. One of them is on one side of the potential, the other was in the other side of the potential. If mu was large, such things were not produced copiously. The amplitude to produce them was suppressed by exponentially. We had to go through the barrier. But if mu equals zero, they were produced copiously. So here, on the other hand, we have to be at mu equals zero, so we shouldn't be surprised that such objects are necessary for unitarity. For completeness, let me put the 2A theory. So we repeat the same thing. We mod out the 0A theory by S duality. It's exactly the same thing. The NS and S sector had a T field, it's gone. The Ramon-Ramon sector had two gauge fields, F and F tilde. One linear combination of them is gone. So we are left with a zero, with one gauge field rather than two, which has physics only in its zero momentum sector, and no tachyon. And what about the twisted sectors? Again, we have to do the opposite projection to what we do in 10 dimensions to find the following spectrum. NSR is e to the minus pi over 2 minus pi bar. Minus I h over 2 plus ipx plus 1 minus p absolute value phi with p negative. And from RNS, we find e to the minus phi minus phi bar over 2 plus ih bar over 2 plus ipx plus 1 minus p phi with p positive. These different minus signs between A and B are really important. So what is the spectrum? The spectrum here includes one left-moving fermion and one right-moving fermion. Very much like in 10 dimensions, the theory on the world sheet is now chiral. The left movers and the right movers are not the same, but the theory is not chiral in space-time. So this is a nice mnemonic to remember, that 2A and 2B differ in their chirality. One of them is chiral on the world sheet, but not in space-time. The other is chiral in space-time, but not in the world sheet. And the same is true for these theories. Are there any questions about this topic? So the last topic I'd like to discuss is compactification. So, can move to the next topic? So compactification is important in string theory. We have to learn what we can, where we can use these models to study compactification. Well, there isn't a lot we can compactify here. We have this space with a linear dilaton. We can't compactify. And we have time. So the only thing we can do is make time Euclidean. Denoted by x, and compactify. The x is identified with x plus 2 pi r. In the bosonic string, that's the only thing we could do. And having such compactification is interpreted as the bosonic string theory at non-zero temperature. So this is a very physical thing we could do, heat the system up and ask, how does it behave as we heat it up? What happens? In the other four theories, 0a, 0b, 2a, and 2b, we have various global Z2 symmetries. So we can compactify it on a circle and perform twists by any of our symmetries and get a whole moduli space of theories. So what we are going to do now is explore this moduli space of theories in the supersymmetric case. And also compute some observables. Any questions about that? So I'm going to start with the bosonic string. We'll see how far we can get. And I'm going to do a calculation of the one-loop partition function. This is a very educational calculation because it uses techniques which actually had been known before this calculation. And these are very common techniques in string theory, and I think it's really appropriate in a school to go through that. Has anybody done here this one torus computation in any of the lectures? The elementary lectures in string theory? No, nobody did that? Okay. So we're going to compute the torus amplitude. And the advantage of this system is that unlike 10 dimensions or 26 dimensions, I'm doing the bosonic string now, is that it's a lot simpler. And in particular, we can perform all the integrals. We get a closed form formula for the free energy. There are two ways of thinking about this computation. Way number one, we set mu to zero, and we compute the free energy. So the free energy is an integral over space, local free energy. And f of phi is a term which is e to the minus 2 phi, sorry, f zero. This is 1 over g string square of phi plus f1 plus e to the 2 phi f2 dot dot, where these terms come from increasing genera. And what we will be computing is this guy, the torus contribution. The second point of view on the subject is to say, no, we are interested in the problem at non-zero mu. And we expand f as a function of mu. And then we have a tree, which is mu squared log mu. Should call it f, call it big F, 1, 0. This is the sphere. Then there is an f1 multiplying log mu. And then there is a 1 over mu squared multiplying f2 plus dot, dot, dot. And what we will be computing is this term. In this prescription, which are actually the same, little f1 and big F1 are exactly the same. It's independent of phi. So it represents the local physics at a given point in phi. And it represents an extensive contribution to the free energy, because we have to integrate it over space. So it will have, among other things, a factor of the volume of space. And we'll be computing this factor up to the infinite factor of the volume of space. Normally, such things come multiplying log mu. So how do we do that? Since it's independent of phi, we might as well be at the weak coupling region, where things are simple. And in the weak coupling region, the theory is free. So we have a free wall shear theory. So we have to compute the integral over the torus. So there are several factors we have to worry about. There are oscillators of x, oscillators of phi, or phi, and oscillators of the BC ghost system. All these oscillators exactly cancel each other. In 26 dimensions, we have 26 x oscillators. Two of them are being canceled by the ghosts. Here we have only two oscillators, so they are just canceled by the ghosts. This is completely analogous to the statement that our field, our target space theory, is a theory with a finite number of particles. We don't have an infinite tower of particles. However, because of the compactification, we have to sum over winding and momenta. So our answer for F1 is an integral over the torus moduli space, tau 2. And there are various pi's and stuff, which I'm going to drop. 1 over root tau 2. And then sum over winding and momenta, q, q being e to the 2 pi I tau. Water, p, alpha prime, the radius, plus w, the radius, over root alpha prime, square, q bar, water, t, square root of alpha prime, over the radius, minus w, the radius, over square root of alpha prime. Have you seen such expressions in this school? Is it the first time that, has anybody introduced this q? Let's start with that. Yes? Has anybody written such sums? Where are the organizers? What kind of school are you running? How do we interpret these terms? The standard descriptions of such terms is when we compactify a spatial direction. And then P labels the momentum of the string around that direction. And W is the winding number of the string around that dimension. In our case, such an interpretation is more confusing because we compactify a time direction. So we have a time direction that we compactify. And what having momentum around the time direction, everybody can understand that, this is usually called energy. But having winding around the time direction is a notoriously confusing notion. This shouldn't stop us from doing the calculation. We can interpret this sum here as sum of terms representing modes in a one-dimensional theory. This is a standard thing in compactification. We think only of the, we think of the theory, the compactified theory, as having an infinite number of modes corresponding to different momentum and winding of the higher dimensional theory. So these are kind of energies or mass of modes in a one-dimensional theory, which is our, only our space. The next step we do, we use Poisson ray summation. Has anybody explained Poisson ray summation here? What am I going to do? I'm not going to explain it. Tau 2 square, and there are some factors of pi that I'm going to drop. This infinite sum can be written in a way that you can find in Polchinski's book. It's actually, I apologize, it's not the organizer's fault. This is in Polchinski's book, so everybody here should have read it. So it's e to the minus pi r square m minus w tau square over alpha prime tau 2. So we keep the W as is, and we'll replace the sum over P by sum over M. And we interpret it as follows. Here is our torus, and the worksheet of the string winds around the torus. It winds W times around this direction, and it winds M times around that direction. So this sum can be thought of as a sum over instant terms. These terms do not have a canonical quantization interpretation. They're not associated with states, unlike these terms. These terms correspond to states in the two-dimensional field theory. These terms, each term here, is a sum, corresponds to a different functional integral, a different sector in the functional integral where the worksheet winds around the torus in different directions. The advantage of this expression is that it's manifestly invariant under the modular group, the two-dimensional modular group that acts on tau. The advantage of this expression is that it's manifestly invariant under t-duality r goes to 1 over r. The fact that the two expressions are the same show that the answer is both invariant under t-duality and invariant under the modular group, as it should be. The next step is to use the fact that this is invariant under the modular group. Have you learned of the modular group? That means yes. Hirose said that this is consistent, that this answer to the question, yes, is consistent, but I realized that if this means no, it's also consistent. So we have to perform this sum, and we have to integrate over tau. And we replace the sum over the two integers, m and w. We just organize the sum differently. We first let m and w, we pull out the maximal common factor, m tilde and w tilde. And then we can use a modular transformation to bring that to the form k 1, 0. So for every pair of numbers m and w, we associate an integer k, which is the greatest common divisor, and an element of the modular group that maps m and w to 1 and 0. Now, instead of performing the modular group transformation on tau, we'll act on the fundamental domain that we integrate over. So here we integrate over the fundamental domain, which in the tau plane looks like that. So our expression here can be written as the term with m equals integral over the fundamental domain of the term with m equals w equals 0, which is not like that, plus an infinite sum over k, the same thing we had before, an integral d2 tau over tau 2 square, e to the minus pi r square over alpha prime tau 2 k square. But this is integrated over the entire strip, going all the way to tau equals 0. This integral can be done, including the sum over k, and it gives an answer which is proportional to 1 over r. This term is an explicit origin that I failed to copy. It should be already here. What's the interpretation of that? This computation is what a field theorist would have done. A field theorist would have said, we have one particle, this tachyon, which is massless. If we want to do a field theory computation, field theory one-loop computation, the answer will be an infinite constant that we are not interested in, which is actually this term, plus a finite term that depends on the radius, which is exactly this expression. It's not just the same answer, but it's exactly the same expression. If you look at field theory books, you will find exactly this expression. So you can put all the factors, and I actually worked them out here. It's a lot of fun. and we end up with F1 being 1 over 24, now I'm writing with all the factors, R over root alpha prime, plus root alpha prime over R. This is a beautiful formula. Unlike the 26-dimensional problem here, we can do everything to the n and get a functional form. And the various terms here have physical interpretation. This term is finite in field theory. And in fact, it can be computed using field theory methods. We don't need string theory for that. Pretend we have a field theory of tachyons, and you get this term, including the coefficient and the normalization. This term, which is proportional to the radius, is the leading term as we take the radius very big. So if we take the radius very big, we get a term proportional to the radius, and we interpret the thing that multiplies the radius as the energy of the system. That energy is infinite in field theory. This thing is infinite in field theory, and hence not calculable, but it is finite in string theory. And it represents the vacuum energy. So this is the vacuum energy, not calculable in field theory and finite here. And this is the field theory expression, which is proportional to 1 over R. Another way of thinking of this expression is to interpret it in terms of temperature. In terms of temperature, what I called F here is really F, is really the free energy divided by temperature. And the temperature is 1 over 2 pi times the radius. So putting all these together, we learn that the free energy has the form some constant A, which comes from the R over alpha prime. You can put all the 2 pi's. Okay, why would I put the 2 pi's? Put all the factors, I think we need a minus sign here, and then we get 1 over 24, 1 over 2 pi root alpha prime. This is the vacuum energy. It's a constant in the free energy, does not contribute to the thermodynamics. In the second term, which represents a gas of particles in 2 dimensions, alpha prime, 2 pi, d squared. And we all know, if you wish, on dimensional grounds, that the free energy in 2 dimensions is proportional to t squared. So this is familiar and satisfying. But this expression has another nice feature that this one does not. This expression is manifestly t-dual. It's t-dual, we can take R to 1 over R, or more precisely, alpha prime over R, and we see that the field theory answer and the vacuum energy exchange roles. And the R goes to 1 over R, the field theory answer, and the vacuum energy, which is not calculable in field theory, exchange roles. This is not visible here because we rescaled by t. One of them is like t squared and the other is a constant. This explains some puzzles you might have. How can we have t duality and the standard inequalities of thermodynamics, which would appear to be in contradiction to each other? But here everything is harmonious. Let us recall how this term was derived. This term was derived in field theory. So more generally, I can write F1 is AR plus B over R. And the term B can be computed, the coefficient B can be computed in field theory. How would we compute it in field theory? We simply have sum over all momenta that can be in the problem. This is a divergent sum. We have to throw away an infinite additive constant. But after we do that, we are left with a finite answer, which leads to this B. This is completely standard in field theory. A is not calculable in field theory. I've said that before. But using this T duality, we can use a similar prescription and say that A is simply a sum over all winding. That's a very, very strange result. Using T duality, it's obviously right. If we think of the system at very small radius, it's the same as another system, very large radius. Sum of a winding of the small radius theory is the same as sum of a momenta of another theory. In that other theory, this term, which is here linear in R, has to be calculable in field theory. We'll do that by sum of a momenta, but that momenta are the windings. And I hope you've managed to follow this chain of reasoning to see why this is right. So this is obviously right. Why can it be wrong? Why is it surprising? It is surprising because there's an object that is not calculable in field theory, this coefficient A, which describes the vacuum energy. This is an interesting finite quantity in string theory, which is not calculable in string theory. And the way we interpret it is that there's a field theory calculation of this thing, which from the point of view of field theory makes no sense whatsoever. We compactify the theory in Euclidean time. We have winding modes around the time direction. This is fact number one, which makes no sense. How can we wind in the time direction? And then we just sum over these winding modes. And that gives us the precise vacuum energy of this system. I really wish somebody could explain to me why this has to be so. What it means to wind around the time direction and why this should give us the vacuum energy. So this is all I wanted to say about this computation. Are there any questions about that? No. Just before lunch, I would like to do one more thing. Yes. Yeah, you could do that even in 10 dimensions. What I said here is the problem. No, that was not. The problem in higher dimensions is that when you do this computation, there is a Hagedorn transition because of the infinite density of states. So as you start to making the radius smaller and smaller, at some point it ceases to make sense. Here, this doesn't happen. There's no high energy density of states. The finite number of particles, everything is finite, everything is sensible, and we have a closed form formula. This is really a beautiful closed form formula. In higher dimensions, this is a mess. Not only is it a mess technically, also conceptually, there's a Hagedorn transition. We don't fully understand what it means to cross it and so forth. If you do the bosonic string in 26 dimensions, for example, compactify, to try to repeat this, the same thing goes through. In fact, it was first done in 26 dimensions. And you push it all the way here, you get something like this, but here there's an infinite sum. And instead of k squared, you have here k squared plus m squared, where you sum over the spectrum of the string. So up to here, it's exactly the same as k squared plus m squared. And this sum cannot be performed in closed form. Any more questions? So the last topic I'd like to do is repeat this thing in the case of the superstring. Now we have a lot more structure. And instead of one nice simple expression, we have 8 simple expressions. Let me explain that. So the first thing we can try and do is take our starting point in all these descriptions, was a zero B theory, and compactify on a circle of radius R. It's clear what we are going to find. We send the radius to zero, very much like in 10 dimensions. We find another theory, zero A, on another radius. R goes to some constant over R. So this theory is not self-dual, unlike the bosonic string. And as we map R to 1 over R, we relate two different theories. One theory at R is the same as another one at 1 over r. We can also compactify both the 0b, either the 0b or the 0a theory, on a twisted circle. What does it mean? We go around, and as we go around, we twist by one of our Z2 symmetries. As we do that, we find our newcomers, 2b and 2a. And if we compactify the 2b theory on the circle, we find the 2a. So this is an interesting part of a moduli space, very much like in 10 dimensions. So here, t-duality acts by saying that theory number one, at radius r, is the same as theory number two, at radius 1 over r. In addition, we had more Z2 symmetries that we can twist by. So if we compactify the 0b theory on another twisted circle, we find a line like that, and like that. These lines, as r goes bigger and bigger and bigger, go out, and then goes back in. So these lines are self-dual. So every one of these theories has a line which under t-duality is mapped to itself. And here there's a point that I really like to stress, not because it's so interesting here, but because it's of general validity. Along these four lines, there is no special point. But in these four lines, there are special points here at the corners. At the corners, the theories have another non-trivial symmetry. They are invariant under t-duality, not to be confused with our s-duality, which was a phenomenon of strong coupling. In every one of these examples, the system has an enhanced non-abelian symmetry. In this case, it's SU2 cross SU2. Here it is SU2 cross SU2. And here there's a single SU2. And here there's a single SU2. And t-duality is embedded inside this SU2. T-duality is a transformation inside these SU2s. These SU2s are very significant. They are precise symmetries of the Wolschmidt theory, not broken by anything. And therefore, this t-duality that we observe at one loop, or we observe at the spectrum, is an exact property of the theory. I know of no other arguments that tell us that t-duality is an exact property of string theory. They are more sophisticated arguments based on a lot more input. But this is really very elementary. Not only does it guarantee it, it also explains why there is t-duality. There is t-duality because there is an enhanced non-abelian symmetry, which part one element of it guarantees t-duality. Now, for every one of these eight line of theories, we can do a computation of F1. And F1, in all cases, is of the form AR plus B over R. In all examples, B is calculable in field theory, as it should be. In all examples, A is not calculable in field theory. But in all examples, A can be calculated by starting from the other end, the same way we did the computation over there. And everything is consistent. So I have a lot more to say about this subject, but I think since all of us want to have lunch, I'll stop here. But before I do that, I'd really like to thank again the organizer for putting together this wonderful set of lectures. I enjoyed a lot the lectures I had to one the last week, and I wish I were here. I was here the whole 3 weeks. Would have learned a lot more. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's what I came for.
Yes. That's, let's think.